is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This election is a wake-up call, especially for the ANC, because it has taken the vote for granted. It's basically said, well, it really doesn't really matter. We're still going to win.
That's independent political analyst Dale McKinley on the poor showing by South Africa's two biggest political parties and a low turnout. Details coming up. Also, six people have died and scores are missing after the collapse of a high-rise building in Nigeria's commercial capital, Lagos. And suspected jihadists kill around 10 civilians in northern Burkina Faso. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa says the United States will continue to engage with both civilian and military leaders in Sudan in an effort to return the country to its transitional government. Jeffrey Feltman told a news conference today that despite General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's statements saying he would proceed with plans for elections and adhere to elements of the 2019 constitutional document that established the civilian-military partnership, his actions are doing the opposite.
To those freedom-loving Sudanese and to those who would seek to rob them of their democratic ambition, I say that the world is watching. The Sudanese people have made clear that they will not accept the military's attempts to sideline their hard-fought democratic transition, and we stand with the people of Sudan.
Speaking by phone from Washington, Feltman said Washington is working with partners such as the European Union, the African Union, the World Bank, the United Nations, and the League of Arab States to help restore the transitional government.
We have been in close touch with our European partners, including France, about how it is that we can support the aspirations of the Sudanese people. This is not about a U.S. or a Franco-American agenda. It's about the Sudanese people's agenda and what we can do to support it. And I think that the generals will realize that they need the support of the international community when it comes to issues such as economic development, debt relief, access to financing via the World Bank and the IMF, but that international support requires getting the transition back on track. The international support derives from forward momentum on the transition.
The ambassador said the U.S. and other involved governments understand there have been problems with implementing the transitional government and the 2019 constitutional document. Civilian and military leaders agreed to the document and set up the transitional government after months of protests led to the ouster of longtime leader Omar al-Bashir in 2019. He said, however, Washington thought those issues could be overcome through negotiations. He was in Khartoum and met with the transitional government leaders just the day before Burhan suspended the transitional government and arrested civilian leaders on October 25th.
The military engaged with us on these various mechanisms that were in line with the Constitutional Declaration of 2019. So I wouldn't go so far as to say they lied. What I would say is they seemed to be talking to us in bad faith because they were talking to us about how to address the concerns they had through constitutional means. And instead, as soon as we left, they decided to just turn over the entire negotiating table in favor of a military takeover. So I'd say it was more that they were meeting with us in bad faith than absolutely lying to us.
Feltman, however, said he saw signs that Sudan's people are looking to find ways to return to the transitional government themselves.
And in terms of negotiations, I know that there are some Sudanese initiatives underway, that there are some attempts by the Sudanese themselves to find a way forward. And you saw evidence, I think, of the Sudanese understanding that they need to get themselves out of this crisis by the conduct of the demonstrations on Saturday. I don't minimize the fact that there were it sounds like three people killed and dozens wounded, which is far too many. But by and large, the protesters, the demonstrators, stayed away from sensitive military locations, which reduced, of course, the potential for conflict and violence. And by and large, not entirely, the military security services exercised restraint. So I think that demonstrated an understanding by the Sudanese people themselves that they have to be careful and find a way back to the civilian-military partnership that this transition required.
The envoy briefly discussed the situation in Ethiopia, where a conflict between the national government and the leaders of the Tigray region is nearly a year old.
Without question, the situation is getting worse, and we are frankly alarmed by the situation. Whether we're talking about access in northern Ethiopia, in Tigray, or we're talking about increased numbers of displaced in the federal Ethiopian state of Amhara, by TPLF military advances, we are alarmed. There has been insufficient access to Tigray since late June, early July. The United Nations estimates that only about 13% of humanitarian needs to the federal state of Tigray have been met, and it's for a number of factors, including fighting, but it's mostly government restrictions, bureaucratic restrictions that have prevented the type of humanitarian access from getting to the people of Tigray. And we see signs of famine and near-famine conditions. There are over 5 million people in conditions of food insecurity now whose needs could be addressed if the government would allow the assistance to flow. And at the same time, you see the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, has moved out of Tigray, south into Amhara, have taken strategic cities of Desi and Kombolcha, and there are tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Amhara who are fleeing TPLF military advances. So that we're calling on all parties to this conflict to find ways to de-escalate the situation, allow the humanitarian access to flow to those in need, be they in Amhara state, be they in Tigray, be they in a far state, and move toward a negotiated ceasefire. The situation is dire, and as I said, it is getting worse.
Feldman said the U.S. would continue to work with partners to help Sudan remain stable and that the situation there remains non-violent. World leaders are gathered in Glasgow, Scotland this week for a pivotal climate summit, COP26. Experts warn that climate change and global warming may reach catastrophic levels if more is not done to address issues such as cutting greenhouse gas emissions. According to the United Nations, about 4 billion people have been affected by events related to the changing climate over the last decade, including deadly floods, wildfires, drought, and malnutrition. Africa 54 correspondent Leonok Dmoudou spoke in an exclusive interview with Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who joined her from the climate summit, and asked him how concerned we should be about climate change.
Climate change is one of the biggest challenges mankind has ever faced, because year by year, because of these carbon emissions, the climate will be getting hotter. And that means particularly anywhere near the equator, the ability to do outdoor farming or outdoor construction work will become impossible. And so that'll really destabilize people who live in these tropical zones. We have to do two things. We have to stop those emissions. And then in the meantime, we need to help countries adapt to these changing weather conditions. For example, you know, giving them better seeds that can deal with the increased temperature. You know, this meeting, I was at the Paris meeting 6 years ago. This one's, you know, bigger and broader. So there is some attention, but, you know, we still have to do a lot more.
The Paris meeting, which happened in 2015, how much progress have been made since then? And how are we going to know that COP26 is a success?
We've deeply engaged the private sector. We've identified the need for innovation and how we get every sector working together to drive that innovation. And we're now paying a significant effort to adaptation. Those three things were not there in Paris. I'm not saying that the commitments here are good enough. We need to say over the next 5 years, the same type of increased engagement on the different issues, including the innovation that's focused on the adaptation.
Innovation is something that you discuss in your book you released this year, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. What sorts of innovation you just mentioned, Sid, what else are you referring to?
The big announcement from us is that we're part of the AIM for C, Adaptation Innovation for Climate Change. A big part of that is this helping the smallholder farmers. A number of countries are announcing increased resources, including President Biden will make significant announcements. We're announcing $315 million over the next 3 years for the seed consortium, which is called the CG system, that makes the seeds for all the different countries. The big priority for that money will be seeds that can be even more productive despite the challenge of climate change. We expect that an additional $1 billion, including our money, will be committed to that effort. That has the potential to benefit literally hundreds of millions of these smallholder farmers.
Some studies show that poor families in developing countries are often the least to blame for man-made climate change. However, they bear the worst of the impact. What are your thoughts on the impact of climate change in underdeveloped countries, especially in a region like Africa?
It's a great injustice. My interest in climate change came from seeing that through our agricultural work in Africa, the farmers were often having a more difficult time. And so they're already facing these difficulties, which will get significantly worse between now and the end of the century. I studied the issue of climate change, and the Gates Foundation took on this adaptation as a big priority. That wasn't getting much attention, so I joined together with some others to create the Commission on Adaptation.
What do you think all of us can do to contribute in this global solution in fighting climate change?
There are products that have lower emissions. It'll be very different in different countries. In the rich countries, you know, we are starting to have food indications of which kinds of food cause what emissions. You know, we have more and more electric cars. For the individual, a political engagement is also important. This is a problem where we have to make near-term investments, you know, even some short-term sacrifice to get the long-term benefit of not having drastic climate change impacts. And so educating people that this is very worth doing, particularly getting young people engaged, you know, we have to start now on this work. It's a tougher problem to solve than even say the pandemic was. The pandemic, we invented one tool, you know, we still don't have that out to everyone, but the vaccine gave us a chance to finish over time the pandemic. With climate change, we need lots and lots of tools.
There are those who still don't believe in climate change, whether it's by willful ignorance or factual ignorance. What do you say to them?
The evidence, sadly, is getting much stronger. I believe this is a very solvable problem. You know, my experience in these last 6 years is that we really are starting the innovations. I've been able to fund through my breakthrough energy efforts a lot of new companies. And now the next 5 years, we need to take those ideas and deploy them, not just in the rich world, but also in developing countries, including Africa.
Bill Gates, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
That was Bill Gates, co-chair of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, in an exclusive interview with Africa 54 correspondent Leonard Moudou. U.S. President Joe Biden issued a notification today to Ethiopia, Guinea, and Mali that he intends to end their designation as beneficiary sub-Saharan African countries under the African Growth and Opportunity Act. A statement from the White House said the three countries are not in compliance with the Act's requirement despite intensive engagement with the U.S. Specifically, he cited Ethiopia for gross violations of internationally recognized human rights, Guinea for not making progress towards protecting the rule of law and of political pluralism, and Mali for both issues cited for Ethiopia and Guinea. Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune has ordered state national energy company Sonatrach to end its commercial relationship with the Moroccan government. Sonatrach, in turn, was ordered to halt natural gas deliveries to Spain due to political tensions with Morocco. Morocco has said Algeria's decision will have little impact on the performance of the national electricity system. William Lawrence, professor of political science and international relations at the American University in Washington, discussed the escalation in tensions between the two countries with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
It's bad for Spain, it's bad for Morocco, and it's bad for Algeria. But it's worse for Spain than anyone else because Algeria accounts for about half of the gas imports in Spain, which makes for about a third of Spanish electricity production. Right in a moment where gas supplies from Russia to Europe are disrupted, and with the end of the pandemic, things are quite tight in terms of energy supplies around the world, which is why prices are rising. So in the midst of all this, Algeria's move threatens the Spanish and Portuguese electricity production, gas supplies in ways that couldn't be more poorly timed. But the impact on Algeria and Morocco in the short to medium term will be rather negligible. They've already made up for about 50% of the loss from Algeria to Spain by increasing the flows directly from Algeria to Spain on an underground, underwater pipeline, as opposed to the one that goes through Morocco. This deal was set to expire on Sunday for a year now. I mean, they knew it. So Morocco could prepare and Algeria could prepare. But the rhetoric around it has gotten significantly worse, you know, over the recent couple of weeks and couple of days as Morocco and Algeria try to blame each other and make things sort of worse in terms of the diplomatic row that's going on. And the main area that Morocco and Algeria were cooperating on has now gone away, which increases the chance that we're going to have a war between the two countries. So, you know, as both countries scramble to make sure that the, you know, the energy flows can be replaced in different ways, the reasons for the country not to have a war just got worse. And the war footing between the two countries, which has been increasing for a year now, just became more likely. And that's concerning for the entire region because a war between Algeria and Morocco could be bad for a lot of countries in the area, not just the two that are facing off against each other over the Western Sahara issue and other issues.
Under the previous agreement, Rabat received royalties worth 0.5 billion cubic meters of gas, which make up half of the country's consumption. What else would Morocco lose following the Algerian decision?
For all three countries, this is just about the price of energy. Even though that was half of them, Morocco's consumption, it was only 9% of their energy production. And so Morocco just needs to get more expensive gas or other sources for its electricity consumption. Algeria will lose money and Spain will lose a lot of money because it has to rush to make up the difference from Asian sources or American sources or other sources at a much higher cost. And then there's a logistical issue in terms of how to get all that gas into Spain in time for winter. So everything's at a much higher cost and will spike everybody's energy prices, not just the Spanish energy prices. But in terms of the income, we'll just lose the cost of the gas. That's it. But it loses prestige too. It's disrupting, it's helping disrupt the European energy supply just at a time where Morocco was trying to play a key role in guaranteeing energy supplies to Europe through its solar energy arrays in the Sahara Desert, Desert Tech and all that. You know, Morocco wants, like Algeria, wants to be seen as a dependable source of energy supplies to Europe. And this just signals to Europe once again that Morocco will do whatever it takes to stake its position on the Western Sahara issue rather than be dependable for Europe. And that makes, let's say, the European desire to sort of disconnect from North Africa a little bit stronger. So that bodes badly, I guess, reputationally for all the countries. And Morocco has been in the midst of a row with Germany, a row with Spain, and a row with EU, all related to Western Sahara. And it was trying to sort of improve its relationships with Europe in the run-up to the COP27 in Glasgow. But it wanted to make its case that it was dependable in the energy arena. And right now, it's showing that it's undependable and would rather score points on the Western Sahara issue than be a dependable partner for Europe.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science and international relations at the American University in Washington, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shenawi. It appears that the major losers in South Africa's local government elections are the country's two biggest parties, and hopes for a bigger turnout from the increasingly restive population. Incomplete returns show the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, with around 46% of yesterday's vote, with the main opposition, Democratic Alliance, the DA, reaching 25%. Darren Taylor has more.
Research organizations project that when all said and done, less than half of 26 million registered voters actually turned up at the polls.
As our elections have taken place, people have gotten more and more angry, a little bit more desperate around socioeconomic service delivery issues, and have pulled out. The largest vote in the last three local government elections has been the no vote.
Independent political analyst Dale McKinley points out that in some ANC strongholds, only a quarter of its traditional support bothered casting ballots.
This election is a wake-up call, especially for the ANC, because it has taken the vote for granted. It's basically said, well, it really doesn't really matter. We're still going to win. We really need to have a much more sort of, I think, mature politics with political parties. They have taken the people for granted, and people are now saying, hey, if you're going to take us for granted, we're going to pull out of this process. And that already begins to bring in the legitimacy of the election in terms of the mandate that's given to the parties that then come victorious.
Even in towns and cities where ANC municipalities have plundered the public purse and failed to deliver basic services, where roads are crumbling and water taps are dry, people didn't vote against the ANC. They simply stayed away from the polls. Groups that monitor local government performance in South Africa say all the worst municipalities, except for a few, are led by the ANC.
We have not always met the aspirations of our people. We are going to do better. So lastly, I wish...
Speaking to the media in Soweto shortly after voting, President Cyril Ramaphosa asked South Africans to give the ANC yet another chance to improve their lives.
We know what the problems are. The problems are clear, and we have said that this time round, we want to correct what has not been going well.
In some metros, the ANC possibly won't get a chance to govern better. Depending on the final vote count, the ruling party could lose control of major cities such as Johannesburg should the DA form coalitions with smaller parties. According to analysts, the massive voter stay away is evidence of an electorate deeply disaffected by ANC corruption and misrule. But it also shows citizens don't trust opposition parties to do much better. DA leader John Steenhuisen says it's rubbish that his party failed to take advantage of the ANC's weaknesses and can celebrate great successes in this election.
Doubling and sometimes tripling our support in ANC strongholds as well in large parts of the country, the Free State, in Mpumalanga, KwaZulu-Natal. We just won two wards of the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal. These are huge advances and achievements. It's early days yet.
He blames the ANC for voter disillusionment.
Having been around the country and seen the dysfunction in so many municipalities, I think a lot of people have given up hope that it can be set right. I mean, it's been a very tough argument to get people excited about their local municipalities again, when for many of them they've had no water, no electricity, sewage running down their streets.
Yet, despite all of this, the ANC remains South Africa's most popular political movement, but with support that's shrinking remarkably. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbiya Baro, thank you again for tuning in.